This is KUT. For decades, a rare collection of human remains sat in a basement at UT. A new book tells the story of that collection and the mysteries that still surround it. KUT's Matt Largie has the tale of these all-but-forgotten specimens and how the attention now being paid to them could lead to new discoveries.
Tell me about the first time that you saw these brains.
Yes. So I was going to borrow a human brain for Scientific American magazine.
This is a guy named Adam Voorhees.
I'm a photographer working here in Austin, Texas.
So back in 2011, this magazine asked Adam to photograph this brain for their cover. They went to see a guy at the University of Texas named Tim Schallert.
Professor Schallert, who it was his brain.
Not literally his brain.
No, he had traded a syphilitic lung for this brain. So he had this, and we went to photograph it. We were unloading everything, and my wife, who works with me, was talking to Professor Schallert. And he's talking to Robin, my wife, and asks if we want to see his collection. And Robin's like, come on, let's go take a look at this. And we walk down the hall, around a corner, into what looks like a chemistry lab, and we go into this little storage closet.
This random old storage closet. But inside was something curious.
One wall is lined, floor to ceiling, too deep of these large jars filled with human brains.
Dozens of brains, about 100 in all, in these glass jars.
Some of them have one, some of them have three, some of them have, I don't know how many, dissected human brains that were teaching brains, kind of wrapped in gauze so they can be opened up and shown what the insides of the brain look like. And, we're kind of immediately struck by that they don't look like normal human brains. They look different.
They were odd shapes, strange colors. Adam could tell there was something wrong with these brains.
Well, we have Parkinson brains.
Charlotte was pointing out things to us, like an Alzheimer's brain, a brain with dementia.
A person died in 1959, Down syndrome brains.
There was one brain that was fairly small and it had almost no folds on it at all. And you just have to wonder what that person's life was like. So it was something that stuck with me and kind of shook me a good deal.
After he left, Adam found himself thinking about these brains a lot. He and his wife went back and took hundreds of pictures of them. He knew nothing about the former owners of the brains, other than what was on a small label attached to each brain jar, basically just what they died from.
So the next thing is I wanted to know more about some of these specific people. So I have a friend who's a journalist.
I'm Alex Hannaford.
He started helping me out and started to do research.
Adam and Alex didn't have a lot to go on. They did have a few details from Professor Schallert. So let's start with what they did know.
Basically, this brain collection was bequeathed to the University of Texas in 1986.
It came from the Austin State Hospital, what they used to call the Texas State Lunatic Asylum. The brains were collected by a doctor there named Coleman Dechenar. It's not clear how legal it all was, but he collected a lot of them.
There was 200 brains in this collection back in 1986, and basically Austin Insane Asylum didn't have room for them anymore.
They didn't know what to do with it, and they were looking at giving it to a university. Yale wanted it, Harvard wanted it.
But the hospital wanted the brains to stay in Texas, so they picked UT. They brought over these 200 brains, put them in a closet in Tim Schallert's lab. 25 years later, Adam shows up. But here's the thing. Now there's only 100 brains.
Somewhere over the last, 20 years or whatever it is, 100 brains have gone missing.
100 of the brains are just gone. And nobody really knows where or why. They've just vanished.
100 brains have gone missing. Have they all been given to someone, sold to somebody, stolen? But we just don't know. We have no idea what happened to them.
So this is mystery number one, and it's just the beginning of the mysteries surrounding these brains. Mysteries that, for the most part, have yet to be solved. Mystery number two, whose brains are these? Remember, each brain is in a jar, each jar has a label, each label has just a tiny bit of information on it.
The labels, basically, they had a case number, a date, and then there was a visual description of the brains in Latin.
Tim was pretty convinced that the medical histories of these patients still existed, and of course, on the jars, we still had the reference number.
So Alex wrote to the state hospital. He did an open records request for the medical histories of the patients using those reference numbers.
And they got back to me and said, we've had a good look. The medical records were almost definitely destroyed. We can't find them, and they're probably destroyed because we only have to keep them for a certain amount of time. And not only that, the reference numbers that I gave them from the jars don't match the reference numbers that they would have had had they had the medical records.
So that's mystery number two. We may never know who owned these brains or what their lives were like, except maybe for one brain. Then this is mystery number three.
The big, you know, da-da-da, you ready for this, Matt? So when I'm talking to Tim about these brains and what's happened to them, he lets it, just drops it into the conversation that among these brains is the brain of Charles Whitman, the UT shooter.
Whitman, of course, is the guy who killed 16 people in 1966 before he was killed by police.
For an hour and a half today, the normally placid university and capital city of Austin, Texas, was held in the grip of a terror which began in killing and ended in killing.
When Charles Whitman was shot, they found a note, and in that note he'd asked that his brain be left to science and looked at by the pathologist to find out if there was something wrong with him. And the pathologist at the time was a guy called Coleman de Chenard.
The same Coleman de Chenard from the state hospital.
And de Chenard did look into Whitman's brain and he dissected it.
De Chenard found a small tumor in Whitman's brain. There was some disagreement about whether it was the reason for his sudden violence. Regardless, Whitman's body was buried in Florida. His brain stayed behind.
We got very excited when we found that the on the autopsy report, there's a reference number for Whitman's brain, and it followed the same pattern as all the other reference numbers on the brain. So literally, we ran, me and Tim and his assistant, ran back into the store cupboard.
They furiously scanned all the labels, looking for a match.
He said, might still be there, might still be.
But
Whitman's brain was not there. So I absolutely categorically can say Whitman's brain is one of the ones that's gone missing.
So what do you ultimately take away from this whole pursuit? I mean, is it kind of unsatisfying for you? Because, I mean, you didn't exactly get what you set out for.
Yes, it was unsatisfying. What we ended up discovering was just... it was just loss, you know, it was just things missing. Charles Whitman's brain just vanished. Like, how does that happen? I don't know.
But there are some mysteries that these brains might yet solve. You see, ever since Adam dug them out of the closet and started taking pictures of them, the brains have gotten more attention.
The university started to do MRI scans, which is something where they can learn more about the collection or preserve the collection to some extent.
They're making a sort of virtual brain collection with high-resolution images they can study further without cutting up the brains anymore. Here's Tim Shallard again.
One of the interesting things that we can do with these brains is we can look for disorders that patients that didn't have any drugs like they do now, we can compare them. There may be some major things that we'll find about what the drugs do.
The scans are expected to take a little while longer to finish. Meantime, the brains have been moved out of the storage closet into fresh new jars.
For me, the thing I think most about them is a sort of a sadness, actually, because you can't just, you know, look at it as just a brain that actually lived in someone's head. And these people, the fact that they could have been treated for their conditions, or the fact that they could have lived a fairly normal life, you know, outside with their family and friends when they were sort of locked up essentially in a mental asylum, is incredibly sad. I mean, you know, that to me was looking at these brains and thinking, God, this poor person was just, what a life, you know.
But decades later, long after their deaths, in a way, they're still kind of locked up. Their anonymous brains suspended in jars. But now, maybe, that they're getting the attention they lacked in life, these people, or what's left of them, can get the dignity they deserve.
That, to me, is the important thing here, you know. I think it's great that we can actually not just stuff them in a cupboard.
Yeah, I mean, they can have a life after death,
yeah,
almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
The brains may get a new permanent home, too. They're being scanned now, but they might soon be on public display at UT. Adam and Alex will publish a book next month with Adam's photos and the results of Alex's research. They're hoping someone might read it and know something more about the brains. Adam has already heard from a person who's the last to care for them back at the state hospital. Maybe she and others out there may finally be able to answer some questions about these old, forgotten brains. Matt Largie, KUT News.